Thorny subjects this week together, entitled, the series is entitled Preach the Bloody Bible. Some of the difficult stories like we looked at yesterday and tonight's, which is a particularly difficult subject for people to deal with. I'm going to ask you to really work through this with me. This one's not easy to deliver in simple terms. I think the concepts will become readily understandable to you, but we're going to have to think through this one together. So let's do that. What about God ordering the genocide of all those nations in the Bible? What do we say about that? And here's where I want to begin. One of my favorite movies from childhood. The movie was made in 1957. I was only three then. But later, Walt Disney allowed that movie to be shown in movie theaters all across the country, the movie Old Yeller. I was a boy when I saw it. I fell in love with that dog, as did, I think, every boy that ever saw that movie. Envisioned himself being the person who owned a dog that was so loyal, so fiercely loyal, that he'd even take on a bear or an angry cow or a wolf to protect his owner. Now, I'm going to give away something about that movie, so if you've never seen it and thought you might, this is a spoiler alert. Old Yeller dies. And even as a boy, I can remember weeping, because Old Yeller dies at the hands of his young owner, who has to shoot him because he is infected with rabies. Now, as a boy, I thought, that can't happen, surely. There's a way to preserve the life of that dog. That dog's too good. That dog's got too much hero in him to shoot and kill that dog. You can't do that. But that was the boy in me, with a boy's way of thinking and a boy's heart. And as an adult, while I don't know that it makes it a whole lot easier to think about a dog like Old Yeller dying, logically, it had to happen. Because rabies is going to take the life of the animal anyway. But the danger is that that animal will infect others that it bites. And you can't allow that to happen. So to paraphrase the scriptures, it's better that one dog die than that the whole nation perish. It is better, even though we don't understand it with our hearts, when we adopt a logical, mature mind, we understand sometimes these things have to happen. But because of the way some stories are told in the Bible, and because of the apparent violence that is multiplied many times over from this death of a dog, some people have drawn conclusions about the Bible and about the God of the Bible that are very radical but need to be addressed, like this. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. That's the opinion of our God by Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion. Is our God that God? Now, listen, I know it's easy for you and me to just say, no, he's not that kind of God. But there's a reason why Richard Dawkins and others reach those kinds of conclusions about God. They reach them based on either a cursory reading or a hearing about what the God of the Old Testament did to some of the enemies of Israel. And I will tell you, I don't believe it's enough to just say, well, he's wrong and our God's not like that. Now let's move on in life, because there are people whom Richard Dawkins has the ears of, who are not as antagonistically opposed to God, but certainly are on the fence about some of the things we'll look at tonight. So I want to just suggest a few things to you, 4 points that I want to deal with in detail tonight about this God of the Old Testament, this God who ordered the genocide of many nations. And I want us to examine that, look at it carefully. Thank you for being here tonight. Thank you. It's not pleasant weather out there. It's great in here. But to get here, you had to go through that. And I know that that was not easy for all of you. And you've come through the rain and come through the cold, and you're here. And that means a lot. And I hope that the things that we'll talk about tonight are going to be helpful to you as we try to understand and comprehend the God of the Bible. Let me suggest 4 things to you. First, we can't limit God to our status. We make a mistake when we try to think of God as being like we are, of having characteristics like we have, of doing things for the reasons we would do things, or refraining from doing things for the reasons we would refrain from doing them. Let me tell you what I mean. A mainline denomination in this country made a decision to exclude from their songbook the song "In Christ Alone." It's a fairly recent song written by Getty Publishing. It has the feel of an old hymn, but it's newly written and it's a beautiful song. Many people enjoy singing it and it moves them deeply. But this mainline denomination said that song will not be in our songbooks any longer. You may wonder why. It was because of this phrase. And on that cross where Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. And this particular religious group could not reconcile the God they believed in and wrath. Their God could not be capable of wrath. So they removed the song. But I think the mistake they made is the very mistake we make here. Because when we think of wrath, it is explosive anger. It's often unwarranted. And even when it is warranted, it is not admirable to see that kind of strong reaction on our part. We don't admire wrath. We don't encourage wrath, because when we think of it, it is uncontrollable, hateful anger. That is not the way God demonstrates wrath. And we make a mistake when we attribute to him the same kinds of emotional underpinnings for his wrath as there is for ours. His is not that kind of emotionally unbearable, untethered anger. That's what it is for us. You want to see it? Get out on the roads and drive for a little bit. You'll see it. It's the fist shaking, the long horn honks, the throwing the hands up in the air, the anger expressed both verbally as well as facially. We call that kind of thing wrath, but that's not the wrath of God. That's not the way the Bible depicts him in that particular role. So when we're talking here about what God did, we make a mistake if we try to think that God thinks like we think about these subjects. I'll give you another example. We don't limit certain officials or professionals from doing things we would limit other people from doing. Some of you know, maybe most or all of you know, that my best friend from childhood is Mark Broyles. We grew up together. And on one occasion, not too long ago, Mark sent me this picture. He said, take a look at this recent picture of me. And it showed a picture of him from the side he had taken with his camera. And he had this long scar down the side of his face. He had been to a doctor and had to have some cancerous tissue removed from the side of his face. It was a long, ugly scar. I know now it wasn't funny, but at the time I thought it would be. So I grabbed that picture and ran into my wife. And I just said to her, I said, look at what happened to Mark. And she looked at the picture and she said, oh my goodness, what? How did that happen? I said, he was sitting in a room and this guy came in a mask and had a knife and just cut him on the cheek like that. And she said, where in the world was he? And I said, oh, in the hospital. And she was angry. That's not funny, she said. I thought she was wrong, and I could do that same thing to my daughters, and they'd find it funny, but they didn't find it any funnier than she did. Now, you see how that story changes, though? If you think it's a person who just has a knife in their hand and cuts under somebody's cheek, it's the same slash, it's the same bleeding, it's the same healing that has to take place. But when you say a doctor did it, you go, oh, that's okay. Now, why is that okay? Because he has a motive and an expertise that the rest of us wouldn't have. If I went around with a box cutter saying, here, let me cut your face like that, I'd be arrested. Law officers carry weapons and they do things with those weapons that you and I aren't allowed to do. I mean, they can carry mace and they can carry tasers. And if we walked around doing what they do, hey, that guy looks suspicious, tase him. We'd be arrested for that. But we trust law officers. Why? Because they have a motive that's different than ours. And they have an expertise that is different than ours. So we will let, we'll let judges condemn someone to die. But we don't let everybody say, I think you should die. I'm going to electrocute you or I'm going to hang you. We won't let people do that, but we let judges make those decisions. And I would suggest to you that in the same way that we make allowances for some people to do things that we wouldn't do and couldn't do ourselves, that we have to think of our God in that same way. Ours is a limited knowledge, folks. We simply don't see what God sees. We don't see things the way God sees things. In Job chapter 1, the latter part of verse 21, Job says, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. The New American Standard says, but it has a note. And listen to here's what it literally says. This is really important. Job did not ascribe unseemliness to God. He did not try to attribute God with an unseemly attitude, manner, or action. We've got to be careful about doing that, about seeing things God does. If you walked into a room and you saw a man in a mask and he was cutting somebody or cutting them up the stomach or had them on their backs and was cutting up their backs, you would do wrong to call the police to have that man arrested if it's in a hospital and he's got on scrubs. Or if she's got on scrubs, male or female. And in the same way, we need to be very careful about saying, God's wrong for doing this. He can't do that. And I'm not saying he can do it just because he's God and he can do whatever he wants. That's ultimately true. But that we make a mistake in our finiteness of limiting God to the finiteness that we have. I'll tell you one more thing about this before we leave this point. We can't let our current cultural mores determine what is right and wrong. Got to be careful about that, folks. Because we're in a culture that says some things are right and some things are wrong. I've never seen a culture that was so consumed with protecting pets as our culture is right now. You know, I mean, I still remember Lyndon Baines Johnson picking up his long-eared beagles by the ears and lifting them off the ground. And there was a little bit of hue and cry about that, but I'm convinced, Democrat or Republican, if he did that today, if a president did that today, they'd impeach him. He'd be gone. I'm seeing things about our culture that's different than other cultures. And we can't judge other cultures by our cultural standards. Those are current, and they may not always be here. My grandfather would have laughed at the thought that there are pet cemeteries and funeral homes in this country. My grandfather would have laughed at that. He said, you've been having bad dreams. Quit eating pizza so late at night. But we do. Now, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. That isn't my point at all. But my point is those things are constantly changing. And when we start trying to judge what's right and wrong by what our current cultural mores are, current cultural Not there are absolute standards of right or wrong. I believe in them. I believe the Bible talks about them. But a lot of the things we're talking about aren't. And so we have people who are upset that we eat certain animals. And I'll tell you what, if you've ever seen a pig slaughtered, it's an ugly sight. It's an ugly sight. Slaughter of a pig is a horrible thing to watch. But there are very few of us that wouldn't say, I'll take more bacon when given the opportunity. I think about that man that was walking down the aisle of the grocery store and he was standing in front of all the cans of tuna. And a lady came up to him and she said, you're not buying that, are you? He said, yeah, I like tuna. Why? And she said, well, because when they net tuna, they get dolphins. And the dolphins get caught in the nets and they die. And he said, not getting your point. She said, dolphins are intelligent. And he said, lady, we ain't netting the smart ones. There's a sense in which we judge other people and their actions by what our cultural thinking is. And we got to be careful about that. And let me offer you one more thought right along those lines. It is rare for us to see a person die. That wasn't true in past cultures. Executions were public. I'm not saying they should be. Don't jump to a conclusion that's not warranted. All I'm saying is we have kind of immunized ourselves from some of the darker aspects of what has to happen for us to exist on this planet. And because we have, we become so sterile in our thinking that we cannot imagine that anything that is distasteful to us could be okay for somebody to do. But that hasn't been the case historically. And so when we judge, you know, God's wrong for striking us a dead, that's a horrible thing to do. For the people of that day, that wasn't, I can't believe I just saw a man die in my presence. They saw it all the time. And they understood those were the processes, the circle of life that goes on. So don't go beyond this point, but know that we need to be careful about limiting God to our view of what's right and wrong, or what's acceptable or not acceptable. We'll make a mistake when we do that. Second point. Now, you got to stay with me on this. Hyperbole, exaggeration, exists in the Bible. And I'm going to say this to you up front. You have one of two choices here. You may be uncomfortable with my conclusion that hyperbole exists. And that's fine if you want to argue it doesn't. But if it doesn't, you're going to have to reconcile the contradictions I'm going to point out to you. So you find a reconciliation for it. I'm not being smart here, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but you only have one of two choices with some of these. You'll see what I mean in just a moment. In Romans chapter 1, verse 8, the Apostle Paul says, the whole world had heard of the faith of the Romans. He says it, the whole world. Now, if that is literally true, you wouldn't be able to go anywhere in the occupied world in that day and said, do you know about the Roman church? And they said, oh yeah, everybody knows about the Roman church. And that's beyond plausible. And you may say, well, that's your best example? Oh no, I'm just getting started. But I'm trying to show you early on that sometimes the Bible speaks in broad terms, and it's not intending to be dishonest. Listen, folks, we do this same thing all the time. Acts 11, verse 28 says, there was a famine throughout the whole world. A famine throughout the whole world. Okay, if there was, how could the saints in Jerusalem send relief? If there's no food anywhere, whole world, how did they send help? Well, it's a general statement, and we do it all the time. We'll say, I'll tell you what, you wouldn't believe it. There will be thousands of people out on the street tomorrow morning for that celebration. Well, are there thousands? I don't know. We use that term, thousands or millions. We throw out numbers like that. There had to be at least 1,000 people there. And what if somebody counted them by heads and said, nope, there was only 889, you liar? We wouldn't do that. Because we're not trying to give any kind of an absolute statement. And now I know this. The Bible often talks about how many people are killed in a battle or killed in a pestilence. When God says 70,000 died, I believe 70,000 died. So we're not talking about exact numbers. When God talks about exact numbers, I figured he counted the heads. If he can count all the hairs on mine, he can count all the heads in a group of people. So I don't question that. But when the terms are broad, like all the world, the whole world, throughout all the world, we're not talking about every single person in the world. We're just talking about a broad representation of people or geography. So let me show you. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, you don't have to turn there. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, we read that Amalek, the Amalekites, were utterly destroyed by Saul. Utterly destroyed by Saul. That's in 1 Samuel chapter 15. If you read that, every Amalekite was killed. If you say, that's what it says. It says utterly, Ralph. It says utterly destroyed. Then would you please tell me who it is David is fighting in 1 Samuel 27 and verse 8? Or 1 Samuel 30 and verse 1 and verse 18? And 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 1 and 1 Chronicles 4 and verse 43. All of those verses mention Amalekites after Saul utterly destroyed them. So do we use terminology like that? Yeah, we do all the time. Hey, how'd the football game go? Oh, they killed us. Call the cops. What do you mean? Oh, it was terrible. It was a slaughter. That's worse. I mean, they slayed everybody on the field. We use terminology like that. We don't mean that to be taken literally. We're not meaning that everybody died. Now, when he destroyed the Amalekites, it was a good slaughter. But we would be wrong to assume that Saul didn't breathe again or rest until he had killed every person on the face of the earth that was called an Amalekite. You're wrong to draw that conclusion because David's fighting Amalekites. And it's after Saul's dead. And they're still there. In Joshua chapter 11, verses 21 and 22, the Anakim, the giants, the Anakim are killed by Joshua. It says he killed the Anakim. That's not Anakim Skywalker. That's with an N on the end, not M. Yet, in Joshua 14, the Anakim are still alive. Well, I thought he killed them. Well, he did kill some. But he didn't utterly destroy them in terms of not a single one was left alive, because they're there in chapter 14. Joshua chapter 10, verse 40 says the Canaanites were utterly destroyed. But Joshua 23, verses 7, 12, and 13 show them that they're still a threatening potential influence for the Israelites. The Israelites are warned about the Canaanites. I thought they were utterly destroyed. Hyperbole. A general statement. Not meant to be taken literally. But it is a general statement that is being made. Now you'll see that again and again, by the way. You'll see different people that are mentioned that way over and over again in the scriptures. And you need to be very careful about drawing the conclusion that the word utterly destroyed means there wasn't a single one of them left anywhere. Because I'll guarantee you, in almost every case, you're going to see them pop up again. And unless you want to conclude they were resurrected and brought back, or somebody was posing as them, you have to know that there's still some of them there. Let me show you something else. In Exodus chapter 23, and I do want you to turn to this one. I'm not just going to cite it. I want to show you something here. In Exodus chapter 23, verse 23. Thank you for turning in your Bibles. Verse 23. For my angel will go before you, God says, and bring you in to the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Termites. Okay, I was seeing if you were reading. And the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. I will completely destroy them. Now go to verse 28. I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will do what? Drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. Verse 31, the end of it, I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me. All right, now you got two different statements by God. You want to try to reconcile those? God says, all the Hivites, Jebusites, Perizzites, Hittites, Canaanites, I will destroy them. And then a few verses later, he says, I'm going to drive them out. Is that a contradiction? I don't think so. There's got to be a way to reconcile those, and the simplest reconciliation for that is, I will destroy them as nations. They will not exist as a people anymore. Where you used to see the Jebusites, they're gone. They're destroyed. They're out of here. Doesn't mean he killed them all. See, when some people read these things, God's killing everybody. Everybody's got an ITE behind their name. God's wiping them all out. He is a brutal God. Nobody lives in front of him. Only Israel is alive. That's not what the scriptures are teaching us. He drove some of them out. Deuteronomy chapter 9, Moses recounts this same event. And in Deuteronomy chapter 9, here's what Moses says about this. Verses 1 through 5. You are crossing over the Jordan today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Great cities, fortified to heaven, a people great and tall. And listen to this, the son of the Anakim. Know that it is the Lord your God who's crossing over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them. There we got it again. Dispossess, destroy, those aren't contradictory terms. By dispossessing them and sending them away, he's destroyed them as a nation. They will not exist as a people any longer. God will drive them out. There's a big difference in driving out and killing. And these scriptures are not telling us that he will kill all of them. He will drive them out. They will live. But they'll live somewhere else as another people. Let me suggest one more thing to you. When they went in to possess Jericho, and God says, you go in, you kill, utterly kill them, men, women, and children. I believe they did that. I believe that he states specifically, men, women, children, animals, kill them. But here's where I think the difference is. You need to know something about Jericho. Jericho was not a city of 100,000 people. The Israelites weren't slaughtering thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people. Jericho wasn't that big. You say, Ralph, how can you say that? How do you know that? Have you ever thought how big a city could be for the Israelites to march all the way around it 7 times in one day? How big could it have been? for the entire army of Israel to march around the outside of it, far enough away that they're not within bow shot. They're not being picked off by the people of Jericho. No, Jericho was not a metropolis. Jericho was a garrison. It was a fortress. Were there people doing business there? Absolutely. Were there citizens there? Yes, there were. But if you're thinking in terms of, my goodness, all the thousands of people that were killed at Jericho, you're making that city way too big for the Israelites to march around it seven times in one day. A few of us went on a great tour of downtown Indianapolis yesterday with Dwayne, and he led us on a walking tour that was grueling, but I don't believe even Dwayne could get around Indianapolis seven times, the outside, seven times in one day. I don't believe he could do that to Brownsburg city limits. Doesn't matter how fast you're walking, it's got to be small enough to get around it seven times in one day. That's what they did. And at the end of the day, there was still enough daylight for them to conquer the city. It's a garrison. And so even when we talk about the slaughter of Jericho, we got to put that in perspective. They did kill everybody in that city except for Rahab and her family. But we're not talking about the slaughter of millions or hundreds of thousands, and probably not even tens of thousands. That many people couldn't have fit in a city small enough to march around it seven times in one day. And if you're thinking, well, you could run around it, maybe they were all marathoners. They've got the Ark of the Covenant in front of them that's being carried by priests on their shoulders. Justice is demanded by God. Now, I'm going to defend to the hilt God's right to exercise his justice in this world. But I want to talk to you for a few moments about what that entails. Because contrary to Dawkins and others, God is not some whimsical God who just says, I don't like them, kill them all. His responses are measured and carefully thought out. He is not malevolently capricious, slaughtering everybody in the whole world. That is not this God of the Bible. Consider in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 16, when Abraham is in conversation with God, and God says, I want to tell you what's going to happen to your family. You're going to go down to Egypt, and you're going to be sojourners in that land of Egypt for a long period of time. You're going to be down there for hundreds of years. He says, listen to this, because the iniquity of the Canaanites is not yet full. God says, I'm paraphrasing this now, but here's what God says. I'm not going to let you occupy the land now because the Canaanites are not wicked enough for me to destroy them. Not yet. Not yet. I'm giving them more time. So how long did he wait? Some 400 years. For justice to be meted out. This is not a God who comes in just swinging left and right to destroy everybody that's done anything wrong. This is a God who waits until he cannot tolerate it anymore. When the iniquity of the Amorites and Canaanites and Hivites and Perizzites and Hittites and Jebusites is full, then Israel becomes his chastening rod. It's the same way in the days of Noah. It says, Peter says that God waited patiently in the days of Noah. Do you know how long? Waited for the world to become wicked enough for him to destroy it. He waited 120 years. He didn't just say, oh, you did one thing wrong, kill them all. That's the God that these atheists and these detractors of the Bible want you to see. But that's not the God of the Bible. And there are pockets of people who are spared, even among those people, because they turn to God. When they turn to God, God spared them. He didn't say, oh, no. You don't get to come to me. You're an Amorite. You're a Moabite. You're a Jebusite. No, you're dead. I don't care. I don't want to hear your apologies. God spared Rahab. Why? She turned to him. In Joshua chapter 3, God sent his testimony ahead of Israel. And the Gibeonites took advantage of it. Now, I know they tricked the Israelites, but God didn't say, oh, no, Gibeonites can't come. When they made that pact, he said, you honor it. They're spared. They're going to live before me. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 25, God issues corporate capital punishment on the Amalekites. On Amalek, God says, that's it. Kill them all. Kill them all. Kill men, women, children, and animals. Kill them all. But before you say, oh, there it is, Ralph. You just admitted it. God did that. How can he do that? How can he take women and children and kill them for the wickedness that maybe a few of them are doing? May I suggest something to you? You go to Leviticus chapter 18, and you look at verses 3 through 30. We're not going to read all that, but I'm going to summarize for you. I want you to know how wicked these people were. I want you to understand the cultures these people lived in. In Leviticus chapter 18, verses 6 through 18, they are guilty of rampant incest. I'm not going to go into detail about this because of children in the audience, but adults know this is inter-family relationships. Brothers and sisters, fathers and daughters, mothers and sons. These are the people. That's what it says. And guilty of unbelievable adultery. Verse 20, they don't ever acknowledge their marital relationships. That's rampant among them. But they offer child sacrifices. They are killing children. The god Molech was a great brass god who had arms extended and a flat metal platform and an open place in the stomach, and it was superheated, and children were placed on that burning platform and then slowly lifted up and dropped into the furnace of the belly of that god by the thousands. They found whole burial grounds with the remains of charred bones of children. Guilty of homosexuality, rampant bestiality, humans and animals sexually mingling. And then verses 24 through 30 say, these are the practices of the Canaanites. This is what they are. I grew up in the Deep South. There is an unwritten, uncoded defense in the Deep South for murder, and it is, he needed killing. Some people just need killing. The Canaanites needed killing. The horrible, immoral lifestyle of those people demanded justice from God. And it's different. The Israelites are not the people of that day. In Joshua chapter 10, when Joshua kills his enemies and they hang their bones up or hang them out, leave them out, they bring them in after the evening because they bury them. They want to give them a proper burial. The Philistines aren't going to do that with Saul. No, they're going to take his body and they're going to pin it up on a wall, and they're going to cut his head off and cut his hands off, and they're going to hang him there. Just hang him there. They're not going to bury him, and they're not going to allow him to be buried. They pile up the heads outside their gates. They treat the dead with the same disrespect that they have for the living. The Neo-Assyrian Annals of Ashurbanipal II describe, forgive me for this, but described flaying the skin off captured armies. They would take soldiers and carefully flay the skin off of them with knives. They would impale them. They would heap their bodies up for show. The Assyrians would place heads in piles. It was not uncommon to gouge out eyes, cut off ears and limbs, and in every way mutilate their enemies. I'll tell you, folks, they needed killing. We would not tolerate that kind of action from a nation of people today. Well, what about killing women and children, though, Ralph? What about that? Well, women were often leavening agents for cultures. In Numbers 25, the Israelites are warned about taking the women into themselves because of the idolatry that can happen with that. Numbers 25, Numbers 31, and if you don't think that can happen, if people are strong, remember Solomon and his many wives that he took on. But I do want to address children for a moment. I do want to offer a couple of things. I'm not here to justify, to my satisfaction or yours, probably, the slaughter of children. But let me suggest to you that children were not likely to be found in numbers in those fortified cities. Those are fortified cities. They're garrisons. They're military bases for fighting forces. And not talking about bases like we have here. We've got down at MacDill Air Force Base where I am, where they've got base housing for families. We're talking about outposts. There weren't that many children in those circumstances. But by taking the lives of even the children, they would not grow up to adopt the sins of their fathers. That's what God says in Numbers 31, verse 17. Nor would they be treated as outcasts and orphans among Israel's people. They would not have that outcast status among the Israelites and have to scrape and scrap for everything they had for the rest of their lives. And I'll suggest one more thing to you. And it's not to say, therefore, the death of all children is this way. But there is one aspect, only one, that I see redeeming in the horrible slaughter of unborn babies in this nation. And it is that I have no doubt that we who make it to heaven will see the souls of those children there. The children die innocent and taken to the presence of God. Let me suggest one last point. I know it's 8 o'clock, but I do want to just simply offer the inconsistencies of the objectors. The people who argue, the Bible is so brutal. It's a horrible book. Look what these people are doing. These are the same people who justify abortion. The killing of innocent babies for convenience sake. It's not even a cultural thing. It's just convenience. In 2011, approximately 1.06 million abortions took place in the U.S. Oh, but you should take courage that that's down from an estimated 1.21 million in 2008, which is down from the 1.29 million in 2003, which is down from the 1.31 million in 2000. which is less than the 1.36 million in 1996. But from 1973 through 2011, our nation approved of the death of 53 million babies. Christians have cried out about that. But I haven't heard the detractors of the Bible argue that's horrible. And the babies they want to defend of the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Perizzites that warrant their defense are in no way purer or more righteous or more worth saving than the millions who've died here in this country and meets with the approval of these people. Further, they don't just disbelieve in the God of the Old Testament. They believe in hell. They disbelieve in heaven. They disbelieve in hell. They disbelieve in salvation. They disbelieve in condemnation. They disbelieve in God. They're not consistent. And that doesn't mean if they're not consistent, we don't listen to anything they have to say. But those very people who are arguing, how can you Christians be consistent in believing in that God and calling him a God of love, don't seem to wrestle at all with their own inconsistencies. To say it's wrong for God to kill babies, but it's not wrong for mere men to kill 53 million of them just since 1973. I really hope that the things that we've talked about are helpful for you tonight. I know it's been a lot of material. And I know that some of it may seem like it's somewhat philosophical or polemic. These are debaters' arguments, but it's not meant to be that way at all. It really comes down to, can we reconcile the God of the Old Testament with his strong sense of justice, with the God of the New Testament, with his strong sense of love and mercy, and are those exclusive? No, they are not. The God of mercy and love is found in the Old Testament, and the God of justice is found in the New Testament. And I believe we can believe these stories are true and right and proper without sacrificing anything about the God we have come to know and believe in and follow with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And his mercy and justice met at the cross of Jesus Christ, where the wrath of God, the cold and logical and calculated justice of God, met Jesus at the cross and produced for us the opportunity to be saved. If there's something we can do for you tonight, something we can pray with you tonight, something we can hear you say about your life tonight that we can pray about so that all of us can meet that God of justice and mercy with confidence that we too shall be saved, I invite you to come to the front while we stand and sing this song.